Good morning, Ithaca, Watkins Glen. This is the Made of Clay Report, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. Our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Bob Prohl. Bob, it's good to have you here this morning.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Bob, the way we start the show is just who are you? What are some of the things that we need to know to start this conversation? I know it's one of the most awkward questions in the world.
So, I'm a Ithaca-based author. I'm a fiction writer. I just had my first novel published back in June, end of June. So that's kind of been, I've been working the book tour and interview circuit of late. Just kind of wrapped that up really last week, I think was like the last event, and so I'm hitting the ground again. So I've been spending the past month talking about this book that is about comic book conventions and parenting, and that's kind of where my headspace is at right now and what I do with my time.
And what preceded your life as a fiction author?
Most recently, I was the events coordinator for Buffalo Street Books, and I worked for the store through the transition to cooperative a couple years ago. Came on there as a bookseller and started just kind of taking on other stuff. And then about, would have been a little over 2 years ago, I left to work on writing full time. Right. Wow. My wife said, you know, you're at a point where you need the time to do it. Why don't you take a year and see what happens? And within a couple months of that, sold my first book.
Wow.
And now that's what I do full time.
Wow. Neat. You brought some music. So, and we're going to start with R.E.M.'s I Am Superman. You want to say anything about it or just play it?
No, again, the songs that I, you know, my whole head is taken up by this book right now. So the songs are kind of going to reflect that. There may be a little superhero and science fiction theme.
Playing its way through the interview.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Sure. Okay. Well, here we go.
I am Superman, and I know what's happening. I am Superman. You don't really love me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Bob Prohl. So, Bob, what experiences have helped to shape you? What has helped to bring you to this point? You look back, you know, what were the more important ones?
You know, as far as like what led me to start writing, it's I don't know that there is one thing. It's just something always been doing. It's always been part of my life. I think a couple years ago, I had a book previous to this that was for a series on music, and basically how that came about was this book series does an open call for proposals every couple of years. I believe they still do. It's called the 33 and a Third Music Series, and each book is about a particular album. And they announced this open call, and I went to all my friends, and I was like, guys, let's write book proposals. And nobody else was quite as excited about that as I was.
As you were.
Yeah. I wrote the proposal, I sent it in, and it got bought for a publication. And that was, working on that book, I spent a year researching and writing it. That's when things kind of changed in my head as far as where writing fit. And that's where it moved from. Writing was always something I did. I didn't self-identify as a writer because I was, you know, I was a barista, I was a bartender, I was, you know, you have a tendency to map that to map your job onto yourself in a certain way. But writing was always a hobby, and that was the first time that I'm like, no, this is something that I might be able to actually pursue professionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea was something that I had moved away from, or not exactly given up on, but kind of backburnered.
Right, right. I mean, it almost becomes, I'm imagining that it was so unrealistic you couldn't really lean on it.
Yeah, that's a lot of it. And, you know, I wasn't in a position economically to go all in on it. And, you know, I had to pay rent. And
right.
And writing is not necessarily going to do that. So that changed, and it wasn't, you know, they didn't pay me much for the book, but there is something that changes about an activity when you're getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
I know that sounds sort of mercenary, but...
Well, actually, I wouldn't put it that way. I would say that the something that is unpaid and completely grounding has a value to it that money would destroy, but something that is paid, which you have been uncertain about, or something which is validated in that really concrete sort of way.
It's that validation.
It's going to make you sing.
Yeah. It's that validation, that sort of affirmation. And, after working on that book and putting that out there, I moved back to writing fiction and focusing on fiction. And I was doing more, music writing and more nonfiction work in addition to that. But that was, I can sort of see a turn in the quality of my fiction writing around that time. And I think it had to do with that mental shift to like thinking about things more professionally rather than like, I'm going to stay up till 4 a.m, like, you know, just with a bottle of whiskey next to me writing fiction. And that's, you know, that's great. And it can be really cathartic and blah, 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 but it's not necessarily going to produce your best work.
Right. Right. And it's not a craft in the sense that.
Right. Yeah. It was, working on that book taught me to be a lot more disciplined. And then I went into working on another novel, which didn't ultimately sell and will sit in a drawer probably forever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that writing that novel and taking the time to do it prepped me to write this one, which was a better book and probably the book that I was meant to start with.
Yeah. Sure. So, you know, this is how you changed, but how did people change in their reaction to you as you began to change how you identified?
I mean, professionally, I started to get more of that kind of affirmation. I got, mm-hmm. you know, I got some fellowships and I got a residency, which is, what actually allowed me to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
It was done at the Salt and Stahl Arts Colony up in Ellis Hollow. And I started, I think partly it changed how I was willing to put myself out there and that I was willing to pursue these things in a sort of professional sphere.
Mm-hmm.
As far as how it changed, like how the people around me perceived me. I mean, I was still, at the time, I was still working jobs and like,
right.
and still really invested in those jobs. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, you know, by that time I was at the bookstore. It was something that meant a lot to me.
And the events, I mean, the bookstore has had amazing events, you know,
over and, the years. And continues to, yeah. Yeah, and it was a good, you know, if you're writing, like, a bookstore job is a pretty sweet gig. not only because, you know, if you're a writer, you should be reading all the time, and you know, hopefully if you're working at a bookstore, you get some sort of employee discount. But also, for me, it gave me a chance to meet and talk with a lot of writers, mm-hmm. And that gave me a start when I was trying to put the novel out there. It gave mm-hmm. me people that I could talk to. And, you know, you start when you have a book that's finished, you're taking it out to agents. And a good place to start is to have people you can, not quite name drop, but, you know, friends who have agents who are published authors.
Right.
And you can say, you know, can I contact your guy? And if they say, all right, then you have some context for the agent to put you in.
Right. So, right. You're not just a blue.
Yeah. Blue. Yeah. Because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of people trying to break in. So having something that sets you a little bit apart is a huge help.
Right. So how did you, you said you came to the point, and maybe this was off air, I'm not sure, where your partner said that, you know, give it a go full time. What allowed that in your lives to kind of happen?
Well, we were kind of feeling stable for maybe the first time, you know.
So quickly, let's mentally, undo it.
Yeah, exactly. Let's undermine this quickly. I think on one hand, it was, you know, it was a very brave and generous thing that she was doing for me, and it was faith in where my work was at that point. I think on the other sneaky hand, like, we were talking about having another kid, and uh-huh. and I think she knew that it was, and I had said, if we have another kid, I'm going to stay home with the baby, and I think she knew that getting me out of the bookstore job was going to be difficult, because uh-huh. it was something and continues to be something that's very important to me.
Right.
So I think part of it was like to ease me into that that change.
It served lots of purposes.
It did, yeah.
Yeah. And most of what we do in life is incredibly complicated when you take it apart. So, and that gets my question about experience. It wasn't like defining experience. What are the kind of the cumulative little shifts, and
right.
little awarenesses and things that pop into our lives that let us do something I never thought I could actually pull that one off. You know? So where are you from?
I'm from Buffalo. I'm from uh-huh. the suburbs of Buffalo, actually.
Uh-huh.
Cheektowaga.
Yeah. And what brought you to Ithaca?
I moved here after graduate school. I went directly to grad school in Boston after undergrad, and then I didn't have a great grad school experience, and I left after a year and kind of bopped around for a little while, a couple mm-hmm. months, you know, moved home for a bit, and I moved to DC briefly, which didn't really work for me. This was in the fall of 2001. So DC was actually a highly paranoid city to be
yes,
in.
Yes. Yes.
In, you know, October and November of that year. And I used to pass through Ithaca on my way to visit friends down in the city,
mm-hmm.
down in New York, and it always seemed, you know, nice. And you know, when you're in your early 20s and you've lived in a college town for the last 4 years, you kind of, there's something about you that wants to replicate or
right.
or extend that. And so I had gone down to DC to sort of scout it for a couple other people, and I didn't like it. And I called my friend who was going to move down there with me, and I was like, yeah, this is not working out. And he's like, yeah, well, I'm living in a cabin in the woods up here, and I can't stand another winter. And I was like, what if we just get like a short-term lease in Ithaca and, you know, take a couple months and figure some things out? And so he found us a place right across from the State Theater, and we moved in. And that was 15 years ago.
Wow.
And I've stuck around the whole time. He moved away and recently came back.
Mm-hmm.
And It just seems to have worked out. It's a nice sized town where it can feel like a small town when you need it to, and it can feel a little bit like a city when you need it to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's a place where if there's something that it's not providing for you, very often you can fix that. You can
right.
say, you know, well, I'll be the one to provide that.
Right. Or I can, it's just big enough that we don't always know what's here. So we can also look a little harder
right.
and sometimes find things too.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's initiative. Yeah. Our own initiative.
Yeah.
Fosters.
And so, you know, I had been here for a couple months and I started working for Gimme, which was a really small company at the time. And it was great to be, that was a really great work environment. There were like 9 of us that worked there. They mm-hmm. had just opened the State Street store. And it was just a really good company to work for starting out in a new town. And, you know, I made some friends and we sort of, me and a couple other people were lamenting things about the music scene and the bands that we liked weren't coming here. So we started calling bands that we liked and started booking, which was not something that I had expected to be doing, but,
uh-huh.
But we did that for a while and that sort of morphed into throwing dance parties and DJing. And it was really that kind of thing. Like, well, there's something that I want. It's not here. I could do that.
Right.
And that was how I spent that's kind of what got me stuck here.
Do you want to unpack that a little bit?
Oh, no. I mean, it's just, there's a...
maybe it's you're planted here.
You didn't intend
to be planted here.
My baby daughter has just started using stuck, started saying stuck for, you know, to mean various things. So I think that's the
it's
first
stuck
word
in your mind.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Yes, yes, yes. But there is, as this is can be a small town where we know everybody, or a larger city where we really don't necessarily know by turns, there is kind of an ambivalence.
Right.
That Ithaca provokes.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, the transitory nature of the populace can be difficult, especially through like a certain span of your life where most of your friends seem to be grad students or adjuncts,
right.
and you know that they've got one foot out the door.
Right.
But
right.
it's also, you know, one of the recent shifts for me is now like having my publisher and my employment down in New York, and that like being able to sort of get out and have another portion of your life elsewhere, it changes what you need from the town.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that, I think that's been really healthy for me in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and my guess would be that what you have just described would capture a lot of people's experience of Ithaca. They are here, but they also have some deep commitments elsewhere, and that allows the allows things to happen that wouldn't otherwise happen in their own sense of satisfaction. It takes them away a little bit in terms of time from being here sometimes.
Right.
But I don't think, having looked at some of the economic and employment statistics over the years, a lot of that stuff, because that's my background is in economic, mm-hmm. community and economic development in city and regional planning, and one of the backgrounds. those kinds of relationships don't get captured well. But it's a big part, I think, of what's happening, or what happens here.
Yeah. You know, I have, there was somebody I met back when I was working at the coffee shop who is a musician, like, mm-hmm. of a pretty notable band. I'm not gonna out him. And I asked him at some point, like, how come you never play music here? How come your band never plays here? And he says, well, that part of my life is elsewhere. And, mm-hmm. like, this is how I want to be perceived here.
Right.
And I think at the time I didn't understand that because I didn't have that separation.
Right,
But now I really appreciate that.
Right, right. And what you're talking about is how we segment ourselves.
Right.
And divide ourselves. And when we're intentional about it, it can be really beautiful. But when it's a reflexive sort of thing that you don't know how to integrate, that's a different sort of thing. And it's a constant challenge knowing how to integrate our personal and our community life, our private and our public life, and the various places that we are.
Yeah. I think if we're choosing a song next, we should probably follow this part of the conversation with David Bowie.
Yes. Yeah, well, sure.
Because that's certainly. Really like that's sort of, I agree, and like having that sense of yourself as a group of myriad parts rather than searching for something sort of integrated in a way, or like,
well,
whole or essential. I don't know.
Well, there's sort of. So you're, let's, can we play with this image for a minute?
Yeah, please.
There are myriad parts, but they interact with each other.
Right.
And you are the one who drives that interaction. That's different than having certain people can't see you in other settings, because that would be a violation of your privacy if you came out in other settings. And then there's the other extreme where you're kind of a one whole blob, which is too precious for words, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And then, but kind of migrating in there becomes differentiated organs or practices or parts of your life. And it's not necessarily on a continuum, but framing it that way allows, I think, us to think with more.
Yeah. I think it's important to, you know, to be able to shift and like to have other parts of yourself that you can shift into.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually like, I'm a pretty private, introverted person, but I also like, I host this trivia night and I host these events and I'm out and I'm up on stages, mm-hmm. and that's important. And it's important for me to have that mode to shift into. But yeah, I think, you know, what I was talking about with the sort of with the David Bowie stuff is that was really important to me, sort of finding his music and his personas as a kid. Is like, you know, I think growing up at a certain age, you're told that there's like this self that you can discover, and I think that's not a theory of self or of how people are constructed that I buy into anymore.
Right. Yeah.
And I think actually for me, searching for that was really difficult. You know, it was really
misleading.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And when I got way into Bowie, and I was like, oh no, there's this other way you can do it, and that's okay too. It's like,
and how would you characterize this other way?
To be constructed of interacting parts.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
To say like I am this person now for this purpose, but later I will be.
Mm-hmm.
I will be this person for this purpose, or like
right.
There's a self that I have for my friends, and there's a self that I take to work, and
right.
There's a self that I am when I'm like alone with my cat, or and all of these things are connected, but they're not. There's not something hiding behind them,
right?
That I need to like find or seek out,
right? It is what it is,
yeah.
And there's no need to press it further. And as an introvert, you prepare to be exposed.
Yeah.
So there are specific times when that happens,
and
it doesn't happen.
Specific yeah. modes.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
I've been out on book tour for the last like month, and it's reminded me that sometimes I'm better at talking at people than talking to or strangers specifically.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the events that have made me really nervous are the ones that are more social, that are more like you're going to do this meet and greet. And I was like, oh,
terror.
I don't want to do meet and greet. Can I just stand up in front of them and they can ask me questions? And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can maintain that part.
Right.
Yeah. Well, here we go. It's Lady Stardust and David Bowie. Oops. Okay. What am I doing here? Let me just. Yes.
The makeup on his face, laughed at his long black hair, his animal grace. The boy in the bright blue jeans jumped up on the stage. Lady Stardust sang songs of darkness and disgrace. Quite out of sight. watch this creature bear. Boys stood upon their chairs to make their point of view. I smiled sadly, for a love I could not obey. Lady Stardust sang songs of darkness and dismay.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Bob Prohl. So, Bob, I hadn't been thinking really. How have you... You've talked about becoming clearer about the pieces of the life that you have and how they integrate. How has... and that there was a time when you were... When you felt like you were on a search for the true self, but that was a misleading or a misguided search, or maybe I've misframed what the issue was.
That's right.
How have you become more deeply the same over the years? What have you had to accept about yourself that you may have tried to reject in that first launch that has stayed with you?
I think I've become more... I've sort of pushed... separated public and private more more stringently than perhaps I have than perhaps I did when I was a kid, in that I think more often when I'm in public now, it's in a performance capacity,
right?
You know, it is doing these events at you know, at bars or at bookstores or whatever, and I was saying during the break that that sort of sense of what you're putting out there versus what you're keeping back, that sort of started for me working in service jobs, you know, working as in coffee shops and working as a bartender, in that there's some, you decide what of yourself you want to, what you want to give away, and what you need to keep protected, or what you need to keep for your friends rather than your customers.
Right, people you have no other interaction with.
Right, right. You know, I was, when I was working at the coffee shop, and I remember just sort of waking up in the middle of the night one night and like worrying about, I'm like, I wonder what's going on with Shelley's brother. And then I realized that I'd never met Shelley's brother, and then I didn't actually know Shelley that well. And like, but she, you know, if you're working a job like that, very often, you know, you're dealing with people on a day-to-day basis, and they're coming to you, and, you know, they say, "How are you doing?" And you say, "You're fine," because, you know, you're behind the counter,
yeah.
and you say, "How are you?" And they give you an honest answer,
right.
And sometimes they're not doing that great, and you're sort of giving something back to them to help them through, and sometimes if you're not careful, you find out that you've given
a piece of yourself
that you can't, that like takes some time to grow back,
right. Right, right. And maybe wasn't the best thing to give.
Right, yeah. I remember one of my coworkers at a low point just saying, like, "I'm just going to extract vials of my blood and hand them out, and maybe that'll keep everybody happy."
Yeah.
But I think, you know, now I know what I want to give when I sort of go out in public when I'm doing stuff that's right. that's more public, and it's more specific, and it's more it's much more performative, and it's much more persona based,
right?
And that's good. Like I've developed those little devices more than I had, you know, 10 right. years ago.
Right. And what is, you are one of a handful of guests who's talked about the public-private distinction, and that's one that we need to be clear about. Oftentimes we conflate it with the personal community distinction, which is a different distinction.
Yeah, I think that's very different.
And implicitly in what you just what you said just a minute ago was there are certain things that you share with your friends that are personal of a nature, but they implicate, or when they affect the people next to you, then they become part of the community.
Right.
And if it's truly private, it doesn't affect the other person necessarily. And so when you're meeting at the counter for a transaction, or when you're performing, that's a different ballpark.
Yeah, it's transactional is another word that's become sort of key to how I think about these things.
Yeah.
It's performative and transactional. Yeah. And there's nothing, it doesn't make them false.
No.
And this is, you know, kind of what I was talking about with that, with the David Bowie stuff, and with thinking of yourself as this collection of parts, is like one is not more authentic than the other. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, particularly as someone who spends all day writing and doing like fairly intense emotional things by themselves.
Right.
That helps that develop a lot. You know, there are things that are just for the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like that mode of expression and making that a key point of my life has helped a lot. And that's like very often writing is how I figure a lot of stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, is it Flannery O'Connor that says like, I write to find out what I don't know. I'm botching both the attribution and the quote.
Yeah. And there's I write to discover what I think.
Yeah, that's, know? Yeah. But it, that's, I don't try to cross those things anymore. And, and now like, I feel like everything's a little more slotted in than it was when I was a youngster.
Right. Well, you have a life that you are intentionally living rather than reacting to.
Right.
And that's, if people have to come to that at some point in order to be able to have families and have long-term relationships and stuff, because when you're in reactive mode, you know, it's hard for other people to line with you,
Up
with you. Yeah. So and this is how have you had to change something about yourself, a quality about yourself that you didn't want to let go? Or has there been anything that you didn't want to let go that you've had to let go because it was just not working?
I mean, there have been lots of things, and, you know, a lot of...
And this is personal and not private. This is where I'm trying to get...
Right.
Yeah.
I think sort of continuing on what we were just talking about is that I've had to, you know, I liked working with the public. I liked working at the bookstore and in service jobs. And there's something about that really engages me. I like having that sort of constant stream of interactions, but it's draining. And it was, I realized at some point that I didn't have the capacity to do that, and also like have the emotional energy for my family anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
not to mention writing.
Not to mention just the physical. You know, I stopped bartending when I was when I became a step parent, because it just didn't. It doesn't. The hours don't work, and
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you're just exhausted all the time. And but even not doing that, even doing other forms of work that is like with the public at large,
mm-hmm.
I realized that as much as it was something that engaged me, it was draining my reserves a little bit, mm-hmm. and I wanted to have more energy to more energy for the people that were closer to me,
mm-hmm.
and so I had to give that stuff up.
And what did you have to? How did you? Okay. What did you have to claim for yourself in order to make it all right to give that stuff up? I mean, usually you don't give up something unless you really have kind of lived into the idea that there's a substantial gain here. There's something that's precious or that I can't violate.
Yeah, it was a matter of like realizing what I had over here and that, you know, that I was taking things away from that for this thing over there. And it was, you know, and actually this is a lot of what the book is about. Hey, I wrote a book. By the way, the book is called 100,000 Worlds, and it is...
I like the name.
it is out all over the place. But the book is... Comic-Cons are sort of a backdrop. The comic book conventions are the sort of mm-hmm, backdrop mm-hmm. for it. But it's mostly a book about parenting, and it's a book I started when I was still a fairly new step-parent. And a lot of it, a lot of what the characters in the book are negotiating is that sort of balance of like where parenting or professionalism or creativity fit and where those balances lie. And where the main character in the book, Valerie Torrey, who's an actress who's sort of stopped working when she became a mother, and now her son is 9, and she's, among other things that are going on, she's rediscovering those parts of herself and rediscovering the importance of those things. And I think, you know, parenting can become, in a lot of ways, all-consuming.
As big as you can give it space for.
Yeah. But it's important, not just to ourselves, but to our kids, that we have these other things going on, mm-hmm. That we engage these other parts of ourselves. And that we come to terms with the selfishness of that.
Right.
You know, when my daughter was born, I basically stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the book was in edits, so every now and then there were things that right. I had to deal with. But for the most part, I was just home with her full time, and mm-hmm. it's great. You know, it's difficult, it's hard work, and it's great. And then it came to the point where, for a lot of reasons, I had to go back to writing. And, you know, it's not... Writing is a weird job in a lot of ways, so there's not a boss saying, like, okay, well, your paternity leave is over, you need to come back. It was a decision I had to make on my own, and it felt very selfish. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like, I'm taking this time for myself, and I'm taking it away from her, and coming to the point where I could say, like, no, but this is important for you too. Like, it's important right. that you have a parent in your life who's whole, who has other stuff going on, and who doesn't shut off parts of themselves.
Right, right. And now you've used the word whole in a non-disparaging way, which is but that's the balance.
Right.
And one of my there's a term, and I'm blocking on it. When something concerns the self, it's making, you know, trying to manage the parts and all the pieces so that it has some integrity, some validity and wholeness. And then there's the self-absorption, which pushes the others away, which is, you know, just you're on your own agenda. And what I hear in your story of giving up some of the work that took you away, made you less emotionally present, meant that you could be more of a person to the people you cared about.
Yeah, exactly.
And our children, if we are overly focused on them, in judgment or in service or whatever, they're not getting the best of us.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be a person before you're a parent, and that, you know, those are both very complicated things, and not losing track of the things that the parts of you that are really important, and that, you know, they'd give you like a different kind of joy.
Right. In a sad way, and I won't go into all the details of it. My mother used to say, even though she'd had 8 children, she talked about the last 2 of us that she raised after the death of our father, as being the ones who we raised her.
Ah.
And there was some poignancy and sadness because of the death of her mother when she was 12 meant that the part of her got stunted.
Right.
But also, it's wonderful if we can be a grounded person by the time we have children. Many of us aren't. And so we have this back and forth piece of trying to become more the person we need to be so that we can be the parent we need to be, or being the parent forces us to go back and look at the person,
right.
You know, and it's a push. It's interesting.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of the other things that I really wanted to look at in the book is that it's, you know, you mentioned about the sense that your kids raise you, and like, in any kid, like, there's something protective that our kids do for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that very often when parenting gets portrayed in, you know, in media and books or whatever, that gets shorted.
Uh-huh.
The sort of caretaking that kids are doing, the protective things that kids do for us, the things about themselves or about the world that they shield us from to some extent. So the book, in following this mother-son relationship, is really, and the point of view switches between the two of them and a couple other characters, and seeing sort of the work that the kid is doing, and seeing how emotionally savvy the kid is, seeing how much he knows, mm-hmm. and how the ways in which he protects his mom from that knowledge, and from the extent to which he's grown up. The ways that he plays at being a kid when in fact he's a little more mature than that.
Yeah. And that is also a challenge for all of us across the life cycle. You know, when our parents are old and we are middle age, and how do we play what we know and play what we don't know, and how do we give up what we can't do anymore as we lose certain abilities . How did the idea for this book come to you?
Well, part of it, like I said, came from being a new step parent and having this, you know, suddenly having this amazing kid in my life and mm-hmm. And just around all the time, and you're trying to figure out who you're going to be to this kid,
mm-hmm.
On one hand, and where the other parts of your life fit around that, and so that was part of it, and part of it, a lot of it was watching him and his mom and mm-hmm. and that really amazing bond and really complicated bond, but a lot of it was just watching him, you know, watching particularly the way that he interacted with stories,
mm-hmm.
and so I have to correct myself because I keep mentioning this in interviews and I somehow I'm like writing my my wife out of the story, but we were all watching Superman, and now I'm a big comic book fan.
Sure.
I've been a big comic book fan since I was basically his age now, so since I was in my teens. So we were watching Superman, like the original Richard Donner, Christopher Reeve Superman, uh-huh. which I love. It's a lot of fun. But I've always hated the ending. It's always bothered me,
mm-hmm.
Which to spoil a 30-year-old movie for everybody, Superman flies backwards around the Earth, causing the Earth's rotation to go backwards, causing time
to go backwards. Yes.
And it's just kind of silly. It's always struck me as kind of silly. And we approached, you know, we're getting to that part of the movie, and my stepson quickly says, oh, as soon as Superman starts flying backwards, he's like, oh, he's going to make time go backwards. And seeing that, like, for an 8 or 9-year-old, that's perfectly plausible,
uh-huh.
that kind of sciencey thinking that you can, you know, there is an explanation, you know, you can imagine that
the possibility of that answer.
Yeah. You know, that if you turn it backwards, like a watch, time moves backwards. And, so seeing that that's the way like kids engage with narrative in like a very different way, in a way that's not proto adult thinking. It's a very specific and very different mode of thinking. So that was sort of one element. And the other element was, starting to go to comic book conventions as an adult, especially the bigger ones. And I was going down to the New York City Comic Con, which is a huge annual convention. It goes for 4 or 5 days, and they bring in like 150,000 people go every year. And I was going up to, I was walking up from Times Square to the Javits Center where it's held, and suddenly there are all the, you can see all these fans sort of start to converge. And and as someone who always read comic books very privately and didn't have a lot of friends who were reading comic books, and it was always something that I would do, like, it was very much a private thing on my own, to suddenly be surrounded by people who are just unabashedly psyched about all this stuff, I was like, this is amazing. I wish I had this when I was a kid. And then the idea to put those two things together, to put a kid in an environment that was made out of stories, or that was full of this kind of enthusiasm for
100,000 worlds.
Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, those two things kind of fused together really quickly, and that became the core of the book.
Cool. Let's cut to music, and then a series of questions, and then we'll be done.
All right.
What would you like to play next?
Oh, what have we played already? Let's play the Material Issue song. The first one on there.
The first one.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's Valerie Loves Me.
Valerie's dancing on the room above my bed, you know. Follow the world below to see. Valerie's leaving on a car outside my house, you know. Such a shame she's not with me, and all the pretty things, and all the love my heart could bring, I would give my whole life to her.
Made of Rick Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Bob Prohl, and this is coming down to the final segment of the show. So, you know, Bob, what do you do to restore yourself daily, weekly, monthly, or whenever you discover the need, physically, emotionally, intellectually? I'm just asking, what do you do to kind of right the ship of your life?
You know, it varies, and I'm very lucky in that. One of the big restorative things for me is work. You know, if I go too long without writing, which is I'm about at that point right now after being on book tour for a month,
a month or 2 months or however
long. Yeah. I am really looking forward to the point in the near future where I get to actually just sit down at a page again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big one, and then it's always. it always feels like a sense of just balance and counterbalance.
Right.
There are times when like what I need is to just listen to music really loud.
And just immerse yourself in it.
Yeah. And there are times that, that what I need is to listen to music really loud in front of, you know, to like get out and DJ and,
right.
and particularly like, I've sort of rediscovered DJing on vinyl, which is, there's something really, again, we talked earlier about, I think off air about mm-hmm. like physical grounding.
Sure.
And, we were talking about the soundboard.
Yeah,
so we're here, you know, we're here in the studio.
30-40-year-old soundboard.
Yeah. And I was saying that I used to work college radio like 20 years ago. And the first time that I came into the RFI studios and put my hands on the board, I was like, oh yeah, like I remember this. And so, you know, like physical manipulation of music, every now and then I'm just like, I need to do that. I need to do that for like at least half an hour or so. And,
right.
So a lot of times it's that kind of thing. It's sort of, I think there's a tendency if you write to get that sense of yourself as a brain in a jar and, to move hard away from that and physically ground yourself.
Uh-huh.
It's important to remind yourself that that you've got a body that you're operating in space.
Right. Right. But you're writing also, I guess I don't see writers, especially fiction writers, as brains in jars, because they're also this pumping heart, and you're processing the emotions of your characters and your points of view and stuff in ways.
Yeah. And it never feels like a brain in the jar when you're at it. It's a very, you know, writing is a pretty physical endeavor
uh-huh.
in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But sometimes just shutting a lot of that noise off and moving more into physical stuff is
right
important.
And what do you do to take care of your body, which is slightly different than physical expression?
Not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I walk. I do a lot of walking. I think, you know, especially having a little person around, there's a lot of like, let's just get in the stroller and walk around. But yeah, I need to. I feel like that's something that now that life is becoming a little more normal again, like I need physical self-care needs to be more of a priority.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was joking that at the end of tour that now that I'm back, I'm going to become like a teetotaling vegan homebody.
Food on the road is oftentimes hard.
Food on the road is oftentimes hard or just gross. I feel like I think I lived on tacos for like a full week. Which I'm not I'm no longer of an age where I can do that.
Right.
So yeah, just I think I'm sort of getting ready to reinstitute a lot of that stuff and like mm-hmm. it's time to eat better and exercise more and again, it's just, it's a counterbalance. It's like a lot of that stuff got a little out of whack and mm-hmm. now it's time to right the ship.
Mm-hmm. Is your office, is your writing space in your home?
It's in my garage.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on it.
Detached or attached, right?
Yeah, I think it's important to have a separate space.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved into the house just before my daughter was born, we were like, oh, well, we'll set up an office space for you here because babies don't need that much space for the first 2 years.
Yes.
Which was ridiculous. And so now I've been displaced out to the garage. Oh. And it's not an ideal space, but it is good, I think, to have, especially if it's what you're doing sort of full time, to say like, okay, at 9 o'clock, I need to be at my desk in the office and not like puttering with the house.
Right. And partly why I asked the question is when you work from home, one of the issues is how do you have the discipline to structure, you know, the taking care of yourself. So being out there at 9 o'clock is part of it. How do you know, how do you signal to your partner, to your child that I'm not available or I need to, how do you know when you need to make those calls?
I mean, I work when everybody's gone.
Uh-huh.
That's what I, you know, unless there's something unless there's something really pressing, you know, like I'm starting out now on a new project, so there's nothing,
right?
There's no deliverable next week,
no deadlines over your head, yeah, yeah.
And so no, I you know, we get everybody breakfast, we get everybody out the door, and then once I'm alone in the house, and even still, like you're alone in the house, and you're like, oh, I could pick up in the baby's area, and there's laundry to be done, and
there's shopping to be done,
yeah, and like that's the important selfish component. Is to say, like, no, this time is my time,
right?
And is work time, and I need to go out to the office and do it. And then, you know, sort of when everybody gets home, say, well, now I still have all these things to do, and there's a reason I don't do this stuff necessarily when you guys are gone, because I need that time,
right,
to work,
right? And you can observe me while I'm doing this stuff, or we can have some interaction, but the household stuff
yeah,
doesn't can't cut into my work life,
yeah. And I think it's a constant negotiation, and it's something like I feel like we're still working out,
yeah. And you may, I from my experience, it's something we work out with every change in our life across every decade, the balance of how to be a partner and a spouse and a house.
Yeah, you know, it's tough because everybody else's work is invisible to you, you know.
Right,
even in a situation where like one person is going to a conventional job,
yeah.
and you're not, like, and I so I'm as guilty of it as I am a victim of it. It's,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Imagining like, oh, you must have had a lunch hour. And I was like, it's not necessarily true that my wife has a lunch hour.
No.
And so,
you and know, all you sorts just... of things happen in that space.
Oh yeah.
And clearing the threshold so you can greet each other, and your threshold is just out the door to the office. I mean, to the,
yeah,
to the garage. Bob, it's been like really good to get to know,
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you.
You want to play Wait for the Sun by Mary Lorson and Saint Lo. Want to say anything about it before we close with it?
Oh, it's just a beautiful song. Okay. And I think this album, a lot of it, I want to be careful talking too much about Mary because she's local and she's fantastic and all this, mm-hmm, kind of stuff. But there's a lot of great stuff about parenting and in here. And it was an album that I listened to a bunch working on the book. So,
yes, so, yeah, yes. And congratulations on your first piece of fiction. Published.
Thank you
fiction,
very much.
100,000 Worlds.
His face turns red and he runs. never think.